You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why e-visits with medical providers aren't resulting in better health for patients.
First, most schools in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin's vouchers programs have already started the new school year. Most of the state schools will start the day after Labor Day. But so far, state lawmakers still haven't passed a new budget, which means schools are gearing up to start a new year without knowing what their funding situation looks like.
Molly Beck is reporting on this. She's a state capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, you talked to some different school officials, and it sounds like, I should say up front, this is not catastrophic for schools around the state,
right.
But what kind of concerns did you hear them raising?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to about half a dozen superintendents yesterday, and most of them they didn't describe this as a crisis or anything, but some did say that they've put off handing out raises to staff. They've put off making last-minute hiring decisions. One superintendent I talked to said that, for example, they wanted to buy new course materials and design a new course around math, and they just have put off doing that because they don't know if they'll have enough money to make that extra expenditure.
And you write that rural schools in particular are a little worried because there's a special kind of state payment that is kind of up in the air for them.
Right. There was a memo that the Department of Public Instruction, which is the state's education agency, they sent to the lawmakers on the budget writing committee last week, saying that if a new budget isn't signed by Governor Walker by August 31st, that first payment that the state sends to rural schools to help cover their costs will be delayed.
And what kind of impact could they have? Possibly needing loans, I guess, bridge loans, in effect?
Right, yeah. I spoke to the a guy that runs the Rural Schools Alliance, and he said that that's one thing that they're looking at is borrowing money because their budgets are so tight anyway.
Let's talk through kind of the dominoes that have to fall here. Schools set their budget, but step one, I guess, is they need to know what they're getting from the state. So once they have that budget picture in place, what happens then for a school district?
Right. So once they know what kind of funding they're getting, they can set, what their tax levy will look like, and they'll know exactly how much money they have to spend on staffing and other things like that. So generally what happens is a school district sets kind of a preliminary spending plan earlier in the summer, and then they get, a projection in July from the state education agency. And then by the end of October, they finalize their actual budget with all the right numbers. In October, that's when DPI, tells them exactly what they're going to get based on enrollment and other things. So basically, it's not a big crisis, I would say, for school districts until, we're in October and there's not a budget.
Right. Is there an idea of if it doesn't happen by blank date, then that's going to push back that domino, that series of events too far, and then we start to run into trouble?
Right. DPI said that if there isn't a budget by October 3rd, then that's going to, create some issues. That deadline, if that's missed on October 3rd, then the calculation that they make to determine how much state aid is deducted from each school district to pay for the private voucher programs and independent charter schools, that could be an incorrect number and not cover the true cost, which means that the rest of it might be picked up by the state's general fund, which could affect other spending. And then by the end of October, if there's no budget by October 27th, then districts might be, they might not be raising enough money in property taxes to cover the cost for the voucher and charter programs.
And Molly, we've talked to your colleagues in the state capitol press corps a lot about this budget process.
Right.
Do we have an idea of when the budget process might be complete? I think nobody is thinking that it's going to take till October.
Right. I'm not getting that sense at all that it would take that long. But I talked to the leaders on the budget writing committee yesterday, and they want it to be done by Labor Day. they weren't saying, yes, it will be done by Labor Day, but that's their goal. And, you know, they are in the Assembly and the Senate. It's the Assembly and the Senate that have not been able to come to an agreement on transportation, causing the delay. And then Governor Walker is actually at an event right now, and I saw on Twitter that he said that he wants to sign the budget before the end of summer so that schools aren't negatively affected.
Talking to Molly Beck, state capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at the as-yet unfinished state budget and how it might affect school budgets as we head into back-to-school season. Some schools around the state already up and running, others just around the corner. Molly, do we know what the state school funding budget is going to look like when all is said and done, or is that still up in the air?
Everybody I've talked to makes it seem like it's not up in the air. I think most people are pretty much in agreement that part of the budget has been settled. The increase in funding that Governor Walker has proposed will stay in the budget, and that means that school districts will get about $649 million in new funding. And a lot of school districts have been really happy about that and counting on that. So I think lawmakers have made that a priority to keep in the budget, even as they're looking at other things to spend money on. But I did talk to State Superintendent Tony Evers yesterday, and he said that while lawmakers are saying that, there's still, you know, the element of this Foxconn investment that will require some state funds. It's not exactly determined how much of the next budget that we're talking about now that will, you know, what they'll need from that. But he said that that's kind of making everybody a little bit nervous about where all that money is going to come from, because there's a lot of money that Governor Walker has proposed for schools.
Yeah, that restored funding to schools, is that a chicken that schools aren't counting before it's hatched at this point? Are they planning on how they're going to spend it before the budget is complete?
Yeah, I think that there's probably some school districts that are moving ahead with that, but I know that, like, the Madison School District, they have put in their preliminary budget a smaller increase than what Governor Walker has proposed, just to make sure, you know, that they're not spending more than what they will get.
Now, we've got, of course, the public schools in Wisconsin. There are also voucher schools. Mm-hmm. What kind of things are they watching as this budget process theoretically comes to a close?
Right. Right now, they're waiting on, they've already started their school year. Like, in Milwaukee School District started their school year this week. And but with the voucher schools, they get a payment per student, and that payment is supposed to increase with this next budget. So they're not, you know, at this point, they don't know, you know, what that figure is right now. They have an idea, and they know what's been proposed, but that's all tied to what the public schools get. So that's up in the air for them, too.
Now, one point you raise in your article on this, and you mentioned it, you alluded to this briefly earlier, is that, you know, a lot of things like staffing and things like that are, of course, in place by now for schools. But there are last-minute changes sometimes. Enrollment turns out to be higher than expected. Teachers leave need to be replaced. Are those things made maybe a little more complicated by the lack of a budget?
Right, yeah. I talked to the superintendent of the Sun Prairie School District in Dane County, and he said that they know that they're going to probably need to hire more teachers for about 100 new students, but they're not really sure how they're going to pay for that yet, because they don't know, you know, what part of their district budget is going to be taken up by state funding. So right now they're kind of, he said, everything's on hold for them right now.
Wisconsin's school funding formula is a big, complicated thing. There have been talks over the years about changing it. I mean, is there enough information in the budget so far that we, the public, that school districts can really look at it and say, okay, if they do what they say they're going to do, legislators and the governor, we really do, we know what the impact is going to be if it's passed as written?
Yeah, they have a pretty good idea. Nobody's talking about a reduction in state funding for schools, so I think that's why you're not hearing more from school districts and superintendents and other school officials about this. If they were worried about funding being cut, it would be a bigger issue for them, because they would need to, you know, cover those costs somehow. But because nobody's talking about that, I think that's why it's not an issue for them at this point. So they're kind of, what I hear is they're taking what you know, Governor Walker has proposed and what lawmakers keep saying they want in the budget and kind of going from there.
And as you watch education funding, Molly, and the state budget in general, what is the next step you're watching for?
Well, with Governor Walker's comments just now saying that he, you know, specifically saying that he wants to make sure that the budget's signed before, you know, most of the schools in the state start on September 5th, then I think that's what I'm watching for, to see if that's actually going to happen, because there are still some pretty big divisions on the transportation funding element of the state budget, which has caused the budget to be delayed by a month and a half. So we will see if they come together that quickly.
We'll leave it there for now. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We've been talking to Molly Beck. She's a state capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. She shared her reporting about how schools in Wisconsin are gearing up to start a new school year without a state budget in place. And just a quick reminder, we still have up on the Central Time Facebook page our question to you about back to school season, not the fiscal side of things, but the sentimental side of things. Let us know how you feel about back to school season. Again, that's on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Carly Schuna fell in love with the German wheel at a juggling festival. Her devotion led her to help found a space for circus arts in Madison that has attracted a wide variety of people and interests. Silke Schmidt went to discover this unique community of athletes.
I was 11 and I was bored one summer. I would like go into my room and put on my new Hanson record, which was 42 minutes long, and I would listen to the whole Hanson CD all the way through and try to juggle my three beanbags throughout the entire duration of the CD without dropping. And after moving to Madison, I discovered the Madison Area Jugglers, and I started going to that club twice a week, and that was the highlight of my life, basically.
Man, I love this man.
That's Carly Schuna. As it turned out, her obsession with juggling that one summer would eventually lead her to
the 47th annual MadFest Juggling Festival,
where she would meet the love of her life.
Luke and I tried rocking in the German wheel, and I just fell in love immediately. I loved everything about the German wheel. I never, ever wanted to get out. I could not stop thinking about it. I dreamed about it every night for 2 weeks, and I bought my own wheel a month later.
Not sure what a German wheel is? You're not alone. Think of a hamster wheel for humans. You climb inside, put your feet into straps, hold on with your hands, and off you go.
The Madison Circus space came into being because Luke and I needed a place to practice our German wheel, and we decided that we needed more people.
My name is Becca Krantz. I was diagnosed with breast cancer in early March of 2015 and was in chemo all, you know, through most of the summer, and then had a double mastectomy in early September of 2015. The kind of breast cancer that I had is a pretty aggressive one and could come back within 3 years, and there's no cure at that point. All these things that I used to say to myself, maybe someday I'll do that, all of a sudden I thought someday could be 3 years from now, could be the limit of my some days. After the surgery, I felt like I want joy to be one of the criteria I use when I'm deciding between things.
A friend said,
"Oh, and you know, there's this class called Introduction to Trapeze for Mature Women." And my eyes just bugged out, and I said, "Yes, I want that." I just knew, like, I want that.
For Becca, the circus space is about
overturning our assumptions about what's possible. I didn't even hesitate. I didn't know if I would be able to do it, but it didn't matter. And so I started going. And in that circus space, I look around, I look at the German wheel. I'd never seen a German wheel before. I had no idea what this was. And it just makes me happy to watch people doing it. And it is totally helping me with my recovery from the double mastectomy, both physically and, I would say, emotionally.
We literally put this space together with our blood, sweat, and tears, and that's part of what makes it so satisfying. Madison is really accepting of people with a wide variety of interests, and it's a really encouraging community.
That story was produced by Silke Schmidt, a science writer in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, new healthcare offerings like e-visits or electronic communication have taken off in recent years. The thinking patients could run a quick question or two by their medical providers and maybe save themselves an in-office visit.
But how is it really panning out? A new study from the UW-Wisconsin School of Business shows the opposite may be happening. In-office visits are actually on the increase over 5 years, meaning that goal of saving time and money hasn't worked out well for patients or providers.
Hassan Bavafa joins us now. He worked on that recent study and is the Wisconsin School of Business Assistant Professor of Operations and Information Management. Hassan, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start off with looking at the electronic visits, e-visits. What was the idea behind them?
So in this research, I think it's a very plausible idea. I teach at the Wisconsin School of Business, and I have many students. And so students can reach out to me by email and take care of many of their questions. So if you think of my office hours as a professor as like office visits for doctors and emails that come from students as questions like the e-visits and questions that come via email from patients, the idea is plausible that some of the face-to-face care can be replaced by emails from patients. And so the idea was that I see that in my teaching, does this translate outside of teaching in a medical field? The idea is that the medical field, the interactions between patients and doctors are far more complex.
Well, how widely are these kinds of electronic visits used these days between doctors and patients?
There has been quite a big explosion in their usage. Like in our data, we see about less than 50 of these emails per month in around 2008, and in 2013 there are already more than 3,000 per month. So in this particular health system, and after 2013, it has been much more prevalent. So they're very prevalent.
And this is over 5 years. So the idea then, as you were saying, maybe these e-visits would save a patient a trip to the doctor, maybe save the doctor some time and save some money for healthcare providers and patients. Does it work that way?
We find that it doesn't. So what we find in this study is that patients who adopt these e-visits have an increase of about 6% in their office visits. So, we also try to measure the effects on health, so to see that if this additional visits and e-visits improve patient health, and we don't find such a thing. And health, we measured it as glucose level and cholesterol levels, which are two common primary care conditions.
And then another question is, if all of these patients who are doing e-visits with their doctors, if some of them end up actually going in when they wouldn't have, is it harder then for other patients to get that appointment with a doctor in office?
So we find a little bit of that. So when we looked at patients who do not adopt e-visits, we see that there is about a 4% reduction in the number of phone interactions they have with their doctors, the patients who don't adopt. And also, more substantially, we find that there is a 15% reduction in the number of new patient visits to providers when they adopt e-visits. And that's, quite substantial, a 15% reduction.
And for doctors themselves, you found, as you were getting at, the additional visits resulted in an additional 45 minutes per month of additional time doctors spent on those visits. Not a huge amount of time given an entire month, but it's definitely not a reversal that might have been expected.
Yes. I mean, both the fact that we didn't find any decrease, like we didn't find time saving, was quite surprising to us. And also, this is for a system that about 15% of patients adopted by 2013 in our health system, and now that number is much higher. So that 45 minutes was when 15% of patients adopt. That's one qualifier. That number is much larger now. Two, it does not include the time it takes the doctors to respond to the emails. This 45 minutes is only additional visits from office visits from patients.
But it may result, it sounds like, in doctors having a little more work to do in responding to these emails they're getting.
That is correct.
And I suppose for patients, the thing is, maybe they would have waited it out and the condition or problem would have resolved. Instead, maybe this triggers a doctor saying, you know what, let's be safe. Why don't you come in and you've got that extra office visit? Is there maybe an abundance of caution that comes into play with this extra communication?
And the research cannot quite directly answer that question, but these are possibilities. I mean, given my conversations with the doctors at the health systems, that's quite a possibility. That if you have a problem, you send an email to your doctor, and in your email you cannot quite describe what is happening. And that email basically triggers the doctor to reach out to you via phone, and some of those phone visits lead to office visits. That's quite a plausible story.
So, Hassam, given that this didn't actually cut down on time or money for patients or doctors, do you think there might be any sort of trend away from e-communication?
So I doubt that. I mean, you see, I mean, the amount of shopping that we do online, and we see like a lot of the university courses are going online. I think we are going to be used to more doing more and more things online. And I think what our study does is paints a picture of what is currently happening at the current form of patient-doctor interactions. And I think what health systems can learn is maybe they should really think about how to target these e-visits. Maybe identify patients that these e-visits may be saving time for them. Identify patients that these e-visits are not saving time for them and is triggering visits for them. So then basically using them more wisely would be the takeaway for me.
Hassam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hassam Bavafa is an assistant professor of operations and information management at the Wisconsin School of Business, joining us to talk about a new study from UW-Madison that shows e-visits increase the number of in-office doctor's visits and don't improve patients' health. This is Central Time.
Now, from the American Revolution to the modern day, there's been an ongoing debate about liberty and oppression when it comes to the government and how much or how little control the government should have over our lives.
Our next guest says we should also be thinking about liberty and tyranny in the workplace. She says employers, especially large-scale employers, exercise too much control over their employees' behavior. In effect, she says they've become a kind of private government.
Elizabeth Anderson is the John Dewey Distinguished University Professor of Philosophy and Women's Studies at the University of Michigan. She's the author of the new book, Private Government: How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Elizabeth, what kind of examples do you see in modern workplaces of employers acting as a private government, a tyrannical, in some cases, private government?
Well, first we can take a look at some tyrannical regulations that take place at work. So, for example, workers in slaughterhouses are very often not allowed to use the bathroom while they're on duty. Imagine having to work in a chilly slaughterhouse for 8 straight hours without that simple privilege and dignity. But there's also a lot of workplace regulations that take place over employees even when they're off duty. So, for instance, you could be fired in most states for saying things or supporting candidates that your employer disagrees with. Only about half of workers even have the most minimal protections for their freedom of speech while they're off duty. And in fact, employers have the right to fire most workers for any or no reason at all. And so just out of the blue, if they decide they don't like something you did, whether on or off duty, you could be canned for that. And many workers are. Most workers are not aware of the fact that they don't have rights to personal liberty on or off duty, and often only find out about it at the point at which they're fired.
And you talk about high-profile companies like Walmart and Amazon and Apple and others. What kind of things do you see going on in those big-name employers that employ a lot of people?
Yes, well, a lot of those employers are pretty notorious for being extremely harassing of employees on the job. This is notorious for Walmart workers in the stores and Amazon workers in the warehouses. they're constantly being yelled at, and their time is minutely micromanaged. The pace of the work is often incredibly high, and workers are accused of time theft if they even exchange pleasantries with each other, taking a slight break from the mad pace of production.
So a response that I think a lot of people would have to this would be, okay, people can leave a job like this. There's a free market. They can go get a job somewhere else, and that ultimately will keep employers in line. If an employer is going too far, they'll lose good employees.
Well, let's keep in mind that in many sectors, there's no place, decent place to escape to. Consider the fact that about 90% of waitresses complain of sexual harassment at the hands of their bosses or the customers that they serve. Who are they going to escape to if they're liable to face sexual harassment wherever they take their talents?
We're talking to Elizabeth Anderson. Her new book is Private Government: How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. And Elizabeth, let's get into that that last point, why we don't talk about it. We talk a lot about where government can and can't infringe on our daily lives. Why do you think we're less concerned when it comes to issues of liberty at work?
Well, I actually think that American history was founded on a very different concept of how the economy was going to work for ordinary people, people who had to work with their hands or had to engage in productive labor, people who couldn't afford to just live off their wealth. If you look at the founding of America, you'll find that the vision that was promoted by revolutionaries such as Tom Paine, he thought that America held out the promise of universal self-employment. Everyone would be their own boss. You'd have a nation of yeoman farmers. They'd own their own land. They'd work for themselves, or self-employed professionals of various sorts, teachers, lawyers, shopkeepers, and so forth. And under those conditions, people really would have liberty at work because they would be governing themselves. That vision was carried forth all the way up to the Civil War by Abraham Lincoln, whose stump speech for his presidential campaign in 1860 explicitly held out the promise that opening up more territory out west and keeping it free of slaves would enable the federal government to give away lots of small plots to enterprising individuals and their families to stake out their own farms. And that was his vision of free labor. What happened was that vision has stuck with us, even though it's become a complete fantasy in today's worlds of large corporations and complex organizations in which the vast majority of workers have to answer to a boss who is legally entitled to exercise arbitrary authority over them, both off on duty and off.
Right. It seems like when you talk about Tom Paine and the vision you laid out from Abraham Lincoln, and you also go back to England and the levelers in the 1600s, the idea would be that the free market would put everybody at a level playing field as opposed to aristocrats who had monopolies over sectors of the economy and lots of inherited wealth. When did we start to lose, as you see it, that level playing field in the American working world?
Well, basically, it all goes back to the Industrial Revolution. So you look at 17th century levelers or even Adam Smith. Adam Smith was writing just barely at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and before machine technology came to dominate manufacturing. His famous pin factory only employed 10 people. At that scale of production, it's pretty easy for a craftsman and his journeyman to have relations, if not of equality, then of camaraderie. They're both doing exactly the same kind of work, and a journeyman had a reasonable expectation of eventually becoming a craftsman himself and independent and self-governing. So what really happened in the Industrial Revolution was you bring in large-scale technology like railroads and steam engines propelling all kinds of manufacturing, and it takes enormous amounts of wealth to build that capital, and it takes many hands to work it. Once that happens, you get a complex organization where bosses are playing a fundamentally different role from the line workers, and bosses come to govern the line workers. And as we know from the history of the Industrial Revolution, the deal that workers got under that system was pretty bad. They didn't have any kind of autonomy at work, and they were worked to exhaustion and had no freedom after work because they were so exhausted they couldn't really do anything except eat and fall asleep in time to wake up the next morning and go back to work.
One argument is then, well, we shouldn't take it too far, but if you're running a complex organization like a railroad in the 1800s or an Amazon delivery system now, you need that kind of centralized control. You need very careful control over the workers to have a successful business that can continue to pay those workers. Is that just a necessary trade-off?
So it is true that once we get large-scale organizations that are needed to produce stuff, there does have to be an internal governing structure. There's going to be a hierarchy of offices. There will be managers and line workers and so forth. And I don't really have a problem with that. My problem is, what is the constitution of that little government of the firm? And there are many ways to design a constitution of government. You could have a democratic government or a government in which workers have some kind of voice. But in fact, the government of the modern productive firm is a dictatorship. It's totally top-down, and bosses have very few constraints on how they can treat workers. We don't draw the distinction between the kinds of orders that bosses issue because it's really needed to get production going efficiently, and the kinds of orders they give to just harass and humiliate workers, or that overshoots what's really necessary to produce the product or service at hand.
We're talking to Elizabeth Anderson, philosophy professor at the University of Michigan. We're talking about her new book, Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you had a job where you felt like your employer had too much control of your behavior on the job, even maybe when you are off the clock? Do you see this as a problem, or is this just part of the free market? If you're an employer, what do you think of this? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with Elizabeth Anderson. She's a philosophy professor at the University of Michigan. And her new book is called Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like your rights are too limited on the job, or is that just part of what it means to have a job? What do you think of our guest's argument that many corporations are, in effect, private governments and not good ones either? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Linda is with us in Madison. Linda, hi.
I think what's missing from this conversation is this is how the labor union got its start in American history many years ago, and by its decline, we're seeing the same problems that had been gave workers a little bit more power and strength come back, and that nothing is going to get better until workers realize there's more of us than them and use their voice and make it better.
Linda, thanks for the call. Elizabeth, you do talk about unions in your book. What's your response?
Yeah, well, I agree entirely that labor unions, the labor movement, was the key movement that helped workers come to see that the free market wasn't delivering the idyllic freedom that was promised to them. And I also agree entirely with the speaker that the fall of labor unions, the decline of labor unions, has led to a lot of lost knowledge about the conditions under which workers live and an inability of workers to really speak out without the protection and a collective knowledge building of representation. The one point where I have worries about the American labor union model is that in order to get representation, workers have to elect to be represented by a labor union. And we know under current regulations, it's incredibly difficult for that hurdle to be passed. It's very easy for employers to intimidate workers out of voting for collective representation, and very easy for them to refuse to bargain in good faith, even though they're legally obligated to do so. So one of the things I do in my book is look abroad to countries like Germany and France, where workers are automatically guaranteed a role of governance in the constitution of any reasonably sized firm, not for the really tiny family-owned shop, but once a firm hits about 50 workers or so, workers are automatically entitled to a voice in government. And that system's known as co-determination. It seems to work really well, especially in Germany, where it was originated. Workers there are really prosperous. And at the same time, they have assurance that their dignity and freedom will be respected on the job as well as off duty, because they have a real voice in the regulations under which they work.
Linda, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Alex in La Crosse. Alex, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Alex?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, kind of shed some light on the fact that, you know, it's not just a, you know, a manufacturing or a production worker who experiences these things. You know, I consider myself middle class, college educated, worked for multiple companies in, you know, La Crosse area with good reputations. And I've experienced things like, you know, being told I'm taking too many bathroom breaks, or being discouraged to use PTO, or, you know, being accused of time theft for maybe punching, you know, in a minute early, or, you know, stopping to talk to somebody at the water cooler. So it is something that exists across, you know, all classes of workers, I believe. So,
Alex, thanks a lot for that call. PTO, personal time off, I believe. Alex brought up bathrooms, and you did earlier, and I was surprised, Elizabeth, there you reference an entire book about the battle for bathroom rights in American workplaces, and we are way behind a lot of other developed countries on that.
Oh, it's quite astonishing. It's really incredible. Here's a basic requirement of human dignity, that you can actually use the bathroom while at work, and it's still denied to hundreds of thousands of employees. It turns out that federal workplace regulations require that employers provide a bathroom, but they don't require that employers actually unlock the bathroom during working hours. So what good is it? In other countries, they just take it for granted that this basic requirement of human physiology and human dignity is respected.
Alex, thanks for calling in as we talk to Elizabeth Anderson, a philosopher. Her new book is Private Government, How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It. Back to our callers. Mark is with us in Viroqua. Mark, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if we've ever considered the fact that maybe we're still in a slavery-type situation, when slaves and all of the doing that they did not belong to them, but it belonged to the plantation owner.
Oop, are you still there, Mark? I think we lost somebody. I think we get the gist, Elizabeth. Obviously, yeah. Substantial differences between slave labor and wage labor, but do you want to speak to Mark's point?
Well, in fact, around the time that the abolition movement was operating, labor movements for legally free workers were rising at the same time, and they drew the explicit analogy between slavery and wage slavery, highlighting the tyranny that employers held over wage workers. I would add, though, that there really is a yawning difference between the two kinds of labor in that free workers had the right to quit. Slaves, of course, didn't have that right. And in fact, free workers had a right to a wage, which slaves, of course, didn't. Free workers had legal personhood. They could sue and be sued. They could own their own property and so forth. And all those rights were denied to slaves. Having said that, though, I do think that there was a lingering legacy of slavery in the attitudes that many employers had over wage workers, free workers, after the abolition of slavery in the United States. And those attitudes can die hard. So even though their legal powers over wage workers were nothing close to the level of tyranny that they had over slaves, nevertheless, that lingering attitude that the caller speaks of, the idea that employers are entitled to complete dictatorial micromanaging control over every last thing a worker does at work, those attitudes, I think, have persisted over time among many employers, and they continue to tyrannize free workers today.
I want to bring it back around to this basic idea of private government, and I think a lot of people might look at that, and conceptually it's kind of weird. We know what a government is, the idea that we subject ourselves to a government by showing up at work. Can you make the case that it's worthwhile to think of it that way?
Yes, so any large, complex organization needs some way to govern itself. It has its own constitution. You have internal relations of authority in which some people issue orders to others and can apply sanctions to those who disobey those orders. That's all it takes to have a government. Our contemporary political discourse, where people are railing all the time against the government, is really talking about the state. The state is just one kind of government, but every organization needs some kind of government in order to maintain itself and to fulfill its functions. Productive organizations are another kind of government. It's a little government, but it's also a private government, and that's really important. By private government, what I mean is a government that's kept private from the workers in the sense that the rulers of that government treat those subject to government as not having any valid interests that they need to consider when rules are being issued. They don't even have to be informed about how that government's going to operate. So it's a commonplace in production that workers could show up one day and find that the factory is shuttered without notice. They've lost their jobs. They don't have to be told about major decisions that's going to affect their lives. That's a kind of private government. It's government where the rulers treat the government, the powers they have, as something that's just their own business and not really any business of the workers.
And we'll leave it there. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Ah, thank you. It's a pleasure to speak to you.
That was Elizabeth Anderson, professor of philosophy and women's studies at the University of Michigan. She's the author of the new book, Private Government: How Employers Rule Our Lives and Why We Don't Talk About It.